times. Here's how Walter had always dreamed of doing it. On Shasta's 25th birthday, he'd suggest taking a bus. The bus going uphill. The one that most days carries her mom and other house cleaners to work. He'd wear his lucky Lamborghini scarf, even if it's so old it's turning back into dirty wool. The two of them would catch the last bus of the night, following the route past that house. Not the house Mrs. Shasta cleans, but the one with Scarlett O'Hara columns lining the front porch, and the roof lines and lightning rods and red brick chimneys rising above the ancestral oak trees. It's the house Shasta has always gawked at the way a dog eyeballs a squirrel, like that pile of bricks and ivy is her pornography. One stop past the house in question, Walter would step off the bus and walk back to where the windows would be dark. When she pulled away, he'd get her, tight around one wrist and tug, gently saying, "It's a surprise," leading her past a statue that creeps him out. It's a monkey made out of that metal, where if you touch it on a cold day, you'd be touching it forever. And anyone who touched you would stick, as would people who touched them, until everyone in the world would be trapped together like Ice Nine and Vonnegut. The little statue brings to mind a little monkey dressed as a clown, maybe to ride a horse only with its face painted white, like in Japan. Walter would cross the damp grass beyond the kabuki-faced monkey clown statuette, past the little yellow sign for the alarm company. To mark the occasion, Walter would pull out his lucky pipe and tamp the bowl full of Hindu Kush. Ever the gentleman, he'd offer Shasta the first hit. He'd pat his hip pocket to double-check for a bulge, a round bulge like old-school Kennedy half-dollars, like pirate doubloons or chocolate geld. In reality, only gold foil-wrapped condoms his ma distributes wholesale. His fingertips would trace the outline of something else, coiled. A larger circle, a loop of something tucked deep in his back pocket. Walter would lead her shivering onto the porch, where and when she'd hide behind a column, standing sideways skinny in the shadows, blocked from the street. She'd be trusting him, but be ready to run. Then in there he'd say, "Let me go get your birthday present," and he'd disappear around the side of the house. She'll cower there, hearing crickets chirp and the hiss of in-ground sprinklers. Smelling this and that, the nighttime air carries swimming pool chlorine and the vanilla fabric softener of billowing steam from some dryer vent. A private security patrol will cruise by playing its searchlight over the hedges. Since her finger-painting days, this house has stood here, filled with history, never changing, a place where she could never imagine feeling afraid. Here and now she's hugging herself behind a column, looking on her phone for a taxi, surfing the neighborhood watch sites to see if anyone's reported two prowlers. The front door creaks open. As if by itself, the paneled white-painted door will swing aside on its brass hinges, nightmare slow. Before she can bolt down the steps comes a whisper from the darkness inside the front hallway, Walter's voice whispering, "Happy birthday, Shasta." Walter will edge his head out until the porch lights puts a white mask on his face, wave a hand for her to come inside. He'll whisper, "It's okay." She'll stand there between the fear she feels and what she wants most, the end of all fear. He'll say, "Hurry." She'll give the empty, dark street one last look and step inside. He'll shut the door. The two of them will kiss until her eyes adjust so she can look around in the half-light. Take note of the brass chandelier holding a forest of fake candles above their heads. Check out the stairway curving down out of the darkness. The carved, leather-scented wood of everything. From somewhere, Walter will hear a clock ticking, loud against the silence. Little smears of light will bounce off a swinging, polished silver pendulum, flicker in shades of blue off the mirror above a fireplace. The thing about Shasta is the taste of her mouth. In his experience, a girl can be beautiful, with all the tits in the world, long legs and a button nose, but a bad-tasting mouth makes her only as good as porn. Shasta, the inside of her mouth, reminds him of high-fructose corn syrup, like soaking maraschino cherries stewed with red number 5 in gelatin, until her tongue has the mouthfeel of a Hostess fruit pie flaking sugar like a baby snake shedding its sweet, dead, sweet skin. Until every French kiss is him deep-throating a semi-molten, sugar-coated snake, like a little garter snake or a garden-variety brown boa. Like Walter's mouth is locked overnight in a delicious combination reptile house and Danish pastry shop. She'll whisper about the alarm system, and he'll point upward. Her gaze will follow his arm to a camera mounted high on one wall. When and where, he'll give her a silent thumbs up. A-OK. He'll explain that he hacked the system. Before they even boarded the bus, Walter deactivated everything remotely. He found a window unlocked in the back. He'd been planning this for weeks. No one will ever know they were here. As irrefutable evidence that he's more than a slack-jawed, single-digit brain cell burner, he'll explain about network enumeration and exploitation. Walter will boast about his genius cryptographic keys while leading her toward the stairs. Shasta will be heel-dragging, whispering about homeowners with shotguns, about stand-your-ground laws. If anyone catches them, Walter will promise to lie. He'll swear that he lured her here to strangle her. He's a serial killer. He's got victims buried in shallow graves all over the American West. He'll pretend to a jury that he told her this was his house. He'd plan to eat Fruit Loops out of the bowl he'd make from her skull. Using her blood, he'd write Helter Skelter on the glass door of the Sub-Zero wine cooler. As an almost butchered woman, she'll get off scot-free. Walter will say that he's already snooped around. No one's home. He'll reach into his back pocket and show her the coil of thin wire. It's ready for when the police frisk him. A garrote for strangling her, with a small wooden peg attached to either end so he can pull it tight. It's her get-out-of-jail-free card. Seeing condoms and a murder weapon will be all the insurance policy she'll need. She can relax. Sex is sex, but sex plus danger is great. The looming threat of being serial killed or getting jail time will bring down her juices faster than green M&Ms. The both of them a tangled knot, he'll go at it until they're half dead. They'll christen every room. If there's a safe, behind a painting or a secret panel in the wall, Walter will find it. He'll press his ear near the dial and listen to the tumblers spin. Before she says not to, he'll throw the handle and open the heavy door, taking only enough cash for 2 first-class one-way tickets to Denver. In Denver, he'll take her on another bus ride to where big houses sit far apart. He'll show her on his phone how he reverse-engineered the security monitoring software. How easy. And she'll follow him around the sides of a house until they find a window unlatched. Before here and now, she's only known him as some baked chode. A hammered nobody who can only afford ditchweed, shake full of seeds and stems. He lives in his ma's basement, where the plumbing growls like a stomach like the sound of an impending bad smell. Shasta likes him okay, but not so much that she'd marry him. By Denver, she's bought into his secret Robin Hood bad boy side. The way he can open doors, abracadabra, and human traffic the two of them into rich, forbidden worlds. After they make love on a bearskin rug and throw the goopy condom into a roaring fire in a stone fireplace under a crystal chandelier, after they drink stolen wine and she washes the glasses and puts everything back, then he'll locate another safe. This one, hidden under the false bottom of a seemingly empty bathroom cabinet. He'll have it open in a flash and withdraw just the money they need to fly to Chicago. That bad boy Walter will completely win her over. Chicago will be a repeat of Denver. Minneapolis will take them to Seattle. As a sign of her newfound awe and respect, she starts referring to his junk as the penis de Milo. In Minneapolis, she slips up and calls him Daddy. Seattle leads to San Francisco, where they'll sneak past the doorman at some Art Deco skyscraper that they'll just happen to be passing one night. He'll hack the elevator code and ride to the penthouse. Using his phone, he'll show her the view from every security camera to prove nobody's home. While Shasta stands lookout near the elevator, he'll trip the locks, then hurry her inside. He'll remind her of the backup scenario: him, serial killer, her, victim. The two of them, outlaws. The next day, they'll be strolling along a dock in Sausalito, where he targets a yacht. They take it out into the bay. Not sailing. He's not that much of a show-off. He'll use the motor and spend a sunny day on the water. On the deck, catching some rays, she'll say, "Show me again." Then and there, he'll pull the coiled wire out of his pocket and demonstrate how easily it fits around her neck, just to give her peace of mind. A locker will yield an array of bikinis, all in perfect-size Shasta. He's neither a tit man nor a leg man, so she's his physical ideal, stretched out on a deck chair, sucking down Durban poison until her skin burns the color of deep-dish chili cheese pepperoni sticks. That same evening, he'll moor the yacht and look for a new safe. This one, hidden by a spice rack camouflaged behind a panel in the galley. The money he finds will get them both down to San Diego. Still, they're trespassers in paradise. She might be having a ball touring the glamorous life with Mr. Douche Danger, but she'll never marry him, and he knows that. As long as her vacation time holds out, they'll hop from San Diego to New Orleans, to Miami. In a waterfront villa, they'll be making love. In a canopy bed alongside big windows that look out on the ocean over a full moon. Not a minute after they've taken each other to heaven and back, the bedroom doors will burst open. Uniformed men train their sidearms on Shasta. The lights blaze bright and she screams, clutching damp sheets over her naked body. "Not like Walter practiced. Not exactly," she screams. "He's a serial killer." Meaning him. She screams, "He told me he lived here." So much for her acting skills. She says, "He planned to strangulate me." A voice among the uniforms yells, "Police!" Commands, "Put your hands where we can see them." This is how it ends, their cross-country crime spree. Bonnie and Clyde without the body count. With the spit still wet on each other, he'll climb out of bed and find his pants. He'll show the police his driver's license. Keeping his hands in the air, his pecker still stuck out so hard it shines, still waving the filled condom like a little white flag, he'll cross the room to an elegant antique French desk. She'll still be in bed, openly weeping, saying, "Thank God! Thank you! He calls this love, but he plans to destroy me." The police won't allow Walter to actually open the desk drawer, so he'll direct an officer to do so. Revealed within, lying on top in plain sight, will be a deed of property ownership. On it, notarized and duly recorded in all public records, will be the same name as on the driver's license. His name. Where and when, in the elegant intonations of a landed aristocrat, he'll explain, smiling, naked, "Officers, I own this house." In the bed, the weeping will stop. Shasta's voice will ask, "Huh?" The two of them had been drinking red wine, and the edge of her glass will have left a thin red Salvador Dali mustache curving up from the corners of her mouth. He'll explain. He owned everything. In Denver, in Seattle, every house is his. He knew the codes, the combinations to the safes. The cash he took was his own. He left the windows unlocked and tipped doorman to look the other way. Even the yacht and the bikinis. Secretly, Walter dialed 911 to bring the cops at this, the perfect moment. Blithely, he'll pull off the condom and cast it aside. Not only is he a brash bad boy douchebag with the stealth and cunning to skate through life and show a girl a good time, he's also rich. He'll be the same old Walter she liked before, only loaded. The regular him, but with so much more to love. With the police officers looking on, their guns lowered, him still naked, her naked. He'll kneel on the floor near his pants. He'll reach into the pocket where the garrote is hidden and bring out a ring. He'll ask, "Will you marry me?" A big diamond ring. There and then, a crew of caterers will arrive with chocolate-dipped strawberries and Mountain Dew-flavored Doritos with garlic popcorn and extra ranch dressing on the side. He'll fire up a big juicy party bowl packed with new purple power, and even the cops will greedily partake. For the honeymoon, him and Shasta will live happily ever after on a tropical isle he owns, reforested with fields of white rhino. Either there, or maybe under a geodesic dome terrarium sunk on the bottom of the ocean, with self-contained recycling everything, surrounded by an ever-changing galaxy of colorful tropical sea life. Whatever the case, this is how he'll propose. There's not enough of him, not yet, to constitute anyone's everything. What he has to do is, first, make a shit ton of money. Tweed O'Neill and her crew beat the first engine company to the raging school inferno. Of course, the fire marshal was already on the scene. Other television news crews were soon to follow, aligning their satellite hookups, each angling for the best view of the blaze. It was the city's fourth school to go up in flames recently. Every outlet worked from the same press releases, but this time, Tweed had brought a secret weapon. Enter Dr. Ramantha Steiger DeSoto, a senior professor of gender studies at the university. The lady doctor was a well-spoken, camera-friendly egghead with her own unique spin on serial arson. Tweed had texted the doctor from the television studio, and the two met up at the crime scene as flames leapt high into the sky, with the gymnasium collapsing slowly behind them, sending up bright geysers of sparks and embers. Tweed blocked out the interview. She and the doctor stood at a safe distance as the cameraman adjusted his focus and the sound technician wired a microphone to the lapel of the doctor's Ann Taylor trench coat. Through her earpiece, Tweed could hear the anchors discussing the fire. In a moment, they'd throw the audience to her live on location. She eyed her competition. None had brought anything new to the story. They were merely passing the fire marshal from setup to setup, and he was giving each outlet the same list of official facts. The doctor appeared unfazed by the bright camera lights and the billowing acrid smoke. Someone had suggested a rumored propane tank, possibly related to the school's kiln, was liable to explode at any instant. Nevertheless, Dr. Steiger DeSoto looked determined to voice her theory about recent events. Standing tall, almost a head taller than Tweed, her frizzy blonde hair was tied up in a sensible bun. She looked every inch the no-nonsense sociologist, who stood ready to enlighten the television viewers. The cameraman shouldered his Steadicam and signaled 3, 2, 1 with his fingers, finally pointing to indicate they'd gone live. "Tweed O'Neill here, at the scene of yet another 3-alarm fire," Tweed began, "marking the destruction of a fourth local school this summer." The cameraman widened the shot to include both women. "With me tonight is Dr. Ramantha Steiger DeSoto to present insight into the motive for these recent fires." Tweed turned to the elegant academic. She tossed, "Your thoughts, doctor?" The doctor wasn't fazed by the attention. "Thank you, Tweed." She faced the camera full on. "Federal criminal profiling shows the average arsonist to be a white male between the ages of 17 and 26. For this man, the act of fire setting is sexual in nature." As if on cue, the rumored propane tank exploded deep within the building, a concussive boom-boom that elicited a deep moan from the crowd present. The doctor continued, "For the pyrophiliac, the act of spraying liquid accelerant equates to expressing his sexual ejaculate in a symbolic, degrading rape of the structure." Collapsing fire and sex meant ratings gold, but Tweed worried that the doctor's language was too highbrow. She tried to redirect. But who? The doctor nodded sagely. Self-isolating men. Right-wing adherents poisoned by the toxic masculinity of the so-called men-going-their-own-way movement. These are your culprits. Tweed tried to lighten the tone. So Maureen Dowd was right? She joked. That having men around is just too high a price to pay for sperm? The doctor smiled weakly. For generations, popular culture has been promoting the idea that all men will eventually attain high-status positions in society. Globally, today's young males have been raised to feel entitled to power and admiration as a birthright. Tweed knew the station was coming up on a hard break. To cap the segment, she asked, Doctor, how can we best deal with today's troubled young men? Backed by the hellish glare of flames, the doctor proclaimed, Men in general need to accept their diminished status in the world. Against a backdrop of smoke and shouting, she added, The impending war, for example, will be an excellent opportunity for them to earn the acclaim they crave. Tweed tossed a commercial. Thank you, Doctor. This is Tweed O'Neill at the pointless destruction of another community landmark. The cameraman signaled the feed had cut. The doctor fumbled with her clip-on mic. Suddenly pensive, she asked, What's he doing? She glared at something in the middle distance. Tweed's gaze followed hers. Both women looked at the fire marshal. Tweed's impression was that he was taking a head count. His attention seemed to settle for a moment on each of the journalists present, and he seemed to be checking them off a list he held. His eyes met hers. His hand holding a pen drew a line through something on the paper he held in his opposite hand. Only now did Tweed notice the little boy. A grade school-aged child with a strange discolored mark running down the side of his face. Then the reality struck her. It was so cute. The district fire marshal had brought his own little son to watch Daddy at work. Watching the two, Tweed made a mental note to spin that touching father and son moment into a feel-good story she could peddle to the network programmers. For Garrett Dawson, it was the coffee filters. In the kitchen working the Mr. Coffee, he found they were almost out of filters. Again. Another 500 pots of coffee gone. Another year. More than a year. He was growing old. Garrett had realized that fact when he made it a habit to look at something. A houseplant, a clock, a book. Before looking at his wife, Roxanne. If he was attending a party and talking to a pretty young woman, somebody's teenage daughter, for instance, or even watching a beautiful woman read the news on cable television, and he looked from her smooth face directly at Roxanne, it was too jarring. In her day, his wife had been beautiful, but she was no longer young. Thus, he needed a buffer between looking at someone youthful and looking at her. An ashtray or a pipe wrench. Something not human. At the same time, he noticed her looking from handsome actors in movies, focusing on her popcorn before directing her attention at him. It might have been his imagination, a projection based on his own behavior, but it reminded him that he was also getting older. The Talbot book put it so well. Beautiful people become powerful because they recognize the nature of power early. And fear losing it. People beautiful in their youth learn to transfer power by investing it in subsequent forms. They trade their youth for education. Their education they invest in developing contacts and expertise and a skill. Their money they invest in redundant forms of power. Backup resources. That is why an expiring form of money is crucial. Power passed from generation to generation in the abstract form of wealth leads to privilege and corruption. Money must not be hoarded for its own sake, but must be continually employed for a fruitful purpose. The coffee filters were the last straw. At the machine shop, Leon had come at him with some cockamamie plan to seize control of the government and reshape the nation. It sounded bogus, but at this point anything sounded better than buying another 500 coffee filters and watching them count down his final years. He poured ground coffee into the last filter and filled the machine with water. He flipped the switch to start brewing. Calling out to Roxanne in the other room, he said, "Coffee ready in a sec." He added, "I'm going out for a minute." He'd give Leon a call. Meet him down by the tavern. Find out if this harebrained scheme was a for-real proposition. Leon had given him the blue-black book, which said, "Imagine there's no God. There is no heaven or hell. There is only your son, and his son, and his son, and the world you leave for them." Roxanne called from the dining room asking where he was headed. As he pulled on his coat, he checked the pockets for his keys and phone. He stepped into the doorway, where she sat at the dinner table, some kind of tax form spread out in front of her. He answered, "We need coffee filters." After a long pull of silence, not looking up, she asked, "Already?" Garrett could hear the defeat in her voice. Life was going by just as quick for her. Another reason to explore some radical options. Leaning over, he whispered, "I got it handled." And he kissed her on the forehead. There had been the age of religion when cities were dominated by their cathedral or mosque. The domes and spires had dwarfed every structure that cowered around them. Then had come the age of commerce, and the skyscrapers of business and fluted columns of banks had dwarfed the churches. Factories outgrew even the largest mosques, and warehouses overshadowed temples. Most recently had begun the age of government, when the buildings regulating civic life had exploded on the horizon. These were vast monoliths containing a power that religion and commerce could only dream of wielding. These were opulent vessels for protecting and showcasing the might of lawgivers and judges. In the final weeks before the adjustment, it was into these great fortresses that ordinary people ventured, pretending to be awed, wandering around them as if they were merely sightseers. They snapped photographs and pretended to be lost, so they could wander into restricted areas and claim innocence when they were apprehended and asked to leave. They mapped possible escape routes they would need to bar, and they determined the locations that would give them the most clear lines of fire. And as they marveled beneath the chandeliers and craned their necks to see the glory of the murals and the gilded ribs of the lofty domes, they knew that food had built this. Food that could have been eaten. Food that had been taken from them. And security had built these marble stairways. Security that could have been theirs. And their lives had been siphoned away so that these walls could be paneled with polished mahogany and rosewood, stuff shipped from around the world to add to the comfort and pleasure of the ruling elite. These hillbillies and rubes with their slack-jawed hangdog expressions, they pretended respect, and they acted out admiration for these grand state houses and the grand potentates who orchestrated their lives from within. They whispered one to the other. They mapped with video. They began to see themselves doing the cold task they had set their minds on doing. And all knew the truth. Hoard food, and it rots. Hoard money, and you rot. Hoard power, and the government rots. Instead of every stupid person having one vote, the smartest, bravest, most bold would have 100 or 300 or 1,000 votes, while the weak and lazy had none. No longer would the most productive be slaves to the idle. The idle would be made to work. On tiptoe, they trickled into the halls of power, stately edifices their sweat had erected, and to which they'd for too long sent themselves by proxy. They came as witnesses to survey the noble settings where their lives would either begin or end. When they gazed up into the soaring granite vaults or down at the acres of polished marble, they felt tiny and weak. But when they crammed into the spectators' gallery, elbow to elbow, knee to knee, forming a single mass, and they surveyed the thin numbers of the duly elected, they felt invincible. They bridled at being grouped into small herds and herded by elderly tour guides who dictated by rote the politically approved meaning of each flag and statue. They dared to picture the great chandeliers shot to pieces. They pictured the galleries with every painting slashed and all the statuary toppled in a jumble to suggest a mass grave of stone heads and severed fingers. They closed their eyes to better envision the tall windows of the statehouse or courthouse shattered, and sparrows building nests in the rotunda's gilded cornices and niches. The media labeled this surge of the curious as an uptick in patriotism, a re-engagement of citizens with their nation. And on that count, the media was correct, but not in the way they assumed. The media depicted the people as pilgrims supplicating themselves before their betters, and the media foresaw a growing future of peace and cooperation, and on this count, they were also correct, but not in the way they'd anticipated. For their part, these newcomers kept their eyes lowered and feigned timidity. In keeping with their low position as plain people, they stepped aside in deference as even the lowliest usher or interns charged through their ranks. In the last days, the tourists flooded into every building of government. Then, as if a switch had been flipped, the gawkers had ceased. The halls were empty except for those who did business. They exchanged nods and shook hands with the guards on duty. Those in uniform and those in street clothes agreeing with their eyes about what needed to happen. All parties in conspiracy toward the one day they'd act together. None but the security guard treated these people with respect, because only the guards and peace officers recognized from whence the real power of the nation arose. For now, crouched in the storage space beneath the south stairs, Nick said, "I don't know. I used to love the police." They leaned against a wall of boxes crammed with old band uniforms. Gold braid showed through where cardboard had split. Brass buttons glowed like treasure in the dim light. Shasta's legs were cramping. Most likely they were breathing asbestos and cancerous chalk dust. Talcum powder was chalk, and talc caused cervical cancer. The world teetered on the brink of war, but Shasta liked it here, thigh to thigh with Nick. Talking felt real. Nothing important ever happened over a telephone. "The truth," Nick said, "used to be easy to find. The truth was inside the newspaper, until it printed an obituary for Nick's dad. It said, 'A beloved husband and father. The deceased died as a result of a cerebral hemorrhoid.' The web picked up the typo, and it ran as a humor piece on hundreds of news sites, even becoming a meme, typically a picture of Ronald Reagan or Gore Vidal bracketed with the words, 'died of a... dot, dot, dot,' along the top margin of the picture, and running along the bottom, 'dot, dot, dot, cerebral hemorrhoid.'" The word everyone was looking for was hemorrhage. Nick's father had been mowing the lawn when an aneurysm in his brain had burst. Just that one word, and the newspaper couldn't get it right. Shasta took pity on him. She tried to explain. Dr. Brawley, in Methods of the Media, he'd explained how modern print journalism, daily newspaper reporting, what we think of when we think of objective, that balanced truth, was killed by Craigslist. Craigslist and Monster and Backpage and eBay. Newspaper profits had always come from the sale of classified ads, These pages and pages of puppies for sale, apartments for rent, used cars, jobs, and SWM seeking SWF, those had been the foundation upon which rested the massive edifice of the Fourth Estate. All of those ads for garage sales and yard sales and Seal Point Siamese kittens, those people seeking to buy World War II souvenirs or fiesta ware or split seasoned firewood, those were the underpinnings of the oldest political dynasties. At a nickel or a dollar per word, those pages had been the gold mine that had financed the high culture. The editorials and book reviews and investigative reporting that was awarded Pulitzer Prizes. According to Dr. Brawley, our brightest, most erudite observations owed their existence to poor people trying to unload vintage Avon cologne bottles and unwanted timeshares. Movies exist, Dr. Brawley had told every class every year, because movies enable theaters to charge you $5 for popcorn. His point was that worthless popcorn supported the glittering world of movie stars and the Academy Awards. In the same way, single worthless words printed for a few dollars per day had supported the colossal newspaper empires. With the passing of newspapers, the credibility of everything came into question. No one was dictating or arguing effectively, defining quality from crap, truth from lies. Without a gatekeeper, an arbiter, everything had equal value. Dr. Brawley had made them read The Sibling Society by Robert Bly. The book said modern society had lost its traditional hierarchy. Be it the patriarch or the matriarch, mothers and fathers had been reduced to the same status as their children. No one wanted to be an adult, and people were friends, peers, equals, rather than teachers and students, reduced to siblings. This flattening of the social hierarchy, Brawley predicted, would lead to populism. Instead of a few enlightened sages, vast numbers of people swayed by emotion and greed would seize the reins of power. Below the stairs, Nick interrupted. "You know he's stoned all the time," Shasta asked. "Robert Bly?" Nick shook his head. "Dr. Brawley." And he told about seeing a transdermal patch stuck to his back where his t-shirt pulled out of his pants. Brawley wore the same t-shirt every May 1st. It was white except for under the arms and had the words "Parlor Pinko" printed on the front in red. It meant he was a fag, people said. The patch was fentanyl. Other days he wore limousine liberal or champagne socialist. Every kid at the University of Oregon could recognize a fentanyl patch or Percocet seen from outer space. Crouched in the dusty space under the stairs, Nick counted on his fingers the things he'd put his faith in. Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy, religion, the Daily Oregonian, the government, Dr. Brawley, and the police. In school, history changed, geography changed. The moment after you passed a test, the facts you learned were obsolete. Now he didn't know what to trust. He wanted to check his telephone messages, but didn't want to risk installing the battery and activating any form of locating device. Shasta checked her phone. No word from Walter. Neither had his mom texted back. She wondered if just a girlfriend could file a missing persons report. It sounded lame. The truth always did. But she offered, "Maybe we all need to start trusting ourselves." To make matters worse, she added, "Maybe you need to trust yourself." Nick scowled at her until she looked away. His voice got intense. "Tell me," he demanded, "everything Walter knew about this big conspiracy." After Piper had read for the part, the casting committee had dismissed the other actors. The job seemed as good as his. Still, the committee conferred. To assure themselves, they'd given him fragments to read. Platitudes, really. For instance, "We must discard past measurements and invent for ourselves what a minute is." These were handwritten on cue cards and held near the camera. An actor's job was to make the unreal believable, to spin imaginary straw into tangible gold. "Moments," Piper read, "are the building blocks of our lives, and our lifetimes must not be measured in weekends. Our time on Earth must not be judged by wages earned and taxes paid." A crew member replaced the cue card and Piper read, "This is Talbot Reynolds, absolute monarch appointed by the Council of Tribes." The director, the man Rufus, asked for another take. "This is Talbot Reynolds," Piper intoned. "Absolute monarch appointed by the Council of Tribes." The casting committee put their heads together in conference. The director asked for another take, a lighter tone, more jovial this go-around. Piper put a smile in his voice. "This is Talbot Reynolds." He lifted his brow slightly to give his face a more open appeal. "Absolute monarch appointed by the Council of Tribes." They changed the cards and had him read Article 7 of the Declaration of Interdependence. "Hoard food, and it rots. Hoard money, and you rot. Hoard power, and the nation rots." They rewound the recording and watched his delivery a second and third time. They nodded as if in mutual agreement. They replaced the cue card with another saying, "You are not going to get loved by being lovable." Nodding, the director said, "With the double exclamation," he added, "please." "We neglect our own destiny," the next card said, "while we impose an arbitrary destiny upon others. Doing so, we ruin both our own lives and theirs." To Piper, it was all gobbledygook, but he delivered each speech with solemn dignity. He read, "Each of us must pursue his or her own destiny and allow others to pursue theirs." He read, "Out of respect, we must not dictate the progress or the goals of others." A hulking brute who smelled of gun smoke, like fireworks and gasoline, approached and used a folded napkin to delicately dab the sweat from Piper's forehead. The crew replaced the card with another. Again, "This is Talbot Reynolds, the absolute monarch appointed by the Council of Tribes." The take was ruined when his stomach growled. This time, the director ordered Piper to read the capitalized letters as if they were capitalized. Piper winged it. "This is Talbot Reynolds, aristocrat supreme, head honcho, grand wizard, the absolute monarch." He dragged it out forever. In the same way people came to pay special homage to the final days of their government, they gathered for long last looks at other relics. They stood in crowds supervising television crews broadcasting from crime scenes, and the reporters were inwardly flattered and felt themselves to be celebrated. And the reporters felt smug in what seemed to be proof of their respected authority in the world. Likewise, the crowds flocked to what they knew to be the farewell lectures by esteemed academics, and those much lauded laureates took such attentive mobs to be a compliment. And these professors felt the future, for the first time in many years, might be an improvement. And both the journalists and the lecturers were mistaken. For schooling had given the people very little in exchange for their money, and the media had given nothing in exchange for the people's time and attention. And now when the crowds came to witness them, it was with bitterness and pity. Others watched with morbid curiosity and sadness, the way they might look upon the last passenger pigeon in existence. For the people knew these were the final days of such institutions, and an event would soon occur that would divide the present from the future. They studied the twilight of such professions so they might describe them to their children someday. With nostalgia, the people stared at the hollow power of the statesman, the journalist, and the professor. And the people silently bid them farewell. From outside Prince Lucian Campbell Hall to Jamal, standing on the quad, the venerable old building looked like the model for Poe's House of Usher. Of quaint and antique design, it towered into the Stygian nighttime sky. A mellow rainbow of green and gold glowed through one distant set of stained glass windows, and a thread of smoke spiraled up from only one crumbling chimney pot to suggest but a single late-night occupant. Jamal motioned to Keyshawn to go first, and the two men pushed past the stout, heavily carved oaken door, its iron hinges crusted red with rust. As they made their way inside, fallen plaster crunched under their tread. The flutter of bat wings reeled through the shadows above their baseball caps. Mounted at intervals along the walls, the elaborate gilded sconces of a bygone epoch threw off weak illumination, flickering and pallid as gas lamps. The two navigated the warren of narrow hallways, the steep-pitched flights of stairs. They braved the grim attic odors of dust and soot. The stone and timber of the great structure held a silence so complete, it made Jamal's hungry ears hallucinate. In the silence he heard words, spoken words, a hushed jumble of faint voices like rushing water, like an audience of phantoms whispering in those dank apartments. One cluster of fetid rooms gave way to another jumbled hodgepodge of rank, ruined stalls and scholastic carrels. Shelves of books, their leather spines furred with mold, stretched out of sight. A metronome sound of dripping water ticked off the moments, and damp had blackened the building's elegant velvet hangings. A nightmare of branching corridors led them past musty, cavernous lecture halls, where Jamal would swear the souls of lost humanities majors still thirsted for revenge, demanded vengeance. As they ought to, he reflected. Generations had been taught the worst brands of social engineering. They'd been drilled and tested until these institutional lies had replaced any rational thinking of their own. The ghosts that inhabited Prince Lucian Campbell Hall wouldn't rest until Jamal and Keyshawn had found the answer they sought tonight. The pair lurched from one ruined level up to the next until a single note struck on a piano caught their attention. A series of notes followed. This, Chopin's Nocturne in E-flat major, led them to an unlocked office. Beyond that lay a moldering suite of rooms, and in the furthest most, they found their objective. Here was an inner sanctum, a plush oasis high in the building where some great man's staff of lackeys had left for the day. Here the walls were impressively paneled in Circassian rosewood, and the fire crackled softly below an elaborately carved overmantel of Italian marble, richly detailed with cavorting putti and heraldic iconography. A setting not atypical for learned senior professors at the University of Oregon. Streaming rays of moonlight lit the rich stained glass windows, scattering ghostly colors that further decorated the arabesque patterns of the room's elegant oriental carpet. Modern touches included a framed poster of Che Guevara, hung above the fireplace. An American flag, also framed, had been hung upside down above the professor's antique desk. One edge of the flag looked eaten away, blackened with singe, from some long-ago attempt to burn it in riotous protest. Arrayed upon the desktop were various rare volumes and costly bibelots. What caught Jamal's eye was a signed sepia-tone photograph of Emma Goldman, mounted on a small bejeweled easel. Near it rested a razor-sharp letter opener of ancient Moorish design. The great man himself dozed in a leather wingback chair. An open copy of Rules for Radicals lay against his chest, half hidden by his ratted gray beard. Despite both the beard and the book, the slogan on his t-shirt was still legible. It read, "This is what a feminist looks like." The legs of his cotton drawstring pants were rolled up, and his pale, wrinkled feet were submerged in a shallow plastic tub of steaming water. Ready, beside the tub, a folded bath towel waited. A crystal decanter of rich amber sherry sat on a small, priceless table beside him. An empty, thimble-sized glass held a golden trace of his last round. Jamal and Keyshawn crept into the room, admiring its historical finery. Knowing these luxuries had been built with the sweat and failed dreams of uncountable liberal art students. The strains of Chopin issued from a shimmering onyx-hued record album that revolved slowly on some ancient heirloom gramophone. The esteemed scholar, Dr. Emmett Brawley, blinked awake.
"To what do I owe this pleasure?" he asked, his roomy eyes fixated, openly captivated by Keyshawn's closely fitted slacks.
Too cowed to speak, the students shifted their weight uncomfortably and stared down at their worn tennis shoes. Abruptly, Jamal looked up and stammered,
"Sir, do you remember Walter Baines?"
A beat later, feeling naked under the brilliant man's leer, Keyshawn insisted,
"We think he's in trouble."
The doctor knitted his brow. Slowly he closed his book and set it aside.
"What brand of trouble?"
Jamal looked to Keyshawn, and they regarded each other with worried eyes. To Brawley, Jamal said,
"It's some list."
To clarify, Keyshawn added,
"A list on the internet?"
He explained the rumor and what little Walter had known. It seemed simple. If you thought a person was a threat to society, you could post his or her name on a certain website. If no one agreed with your nomination, the name would disappear within a few hours. But if several people supported the nomination, the name would linger to attract more possible votes. The more votes a person got, the more danger he or she was facing. Jamal interjected,
"It's like an unpopularity contest."
His hysterical outburst made them all cringe. No one spoke as the burning logs in the fireplace softly popped and sighed. At last, Dr. Brawley laughed. His was a deep and hearty chortle, dismissive and scented with sherry. It displayed every one of his marijuana-stained teeth. As a free-thinking scholar and molder of young minds, it was clear he'd faced many such witch hunts in his long career. As if to calm himself, he reached for the decanter and poured his small glass full. After sipping it, he regarded the amber liquid and smiled wryly.
"Yes, my children," he said. "There has always been a list."
Jamal and Keyshawn hung on his words, eyes wide, their souls filled with dread. The doctor gestured grandly with the tiny glass.
"Sit," he bade them.
The two young listeners sat cross-legged on the carpet at his feet. Brawley spoke down to them.
"There has always been a list. Oh, how human beings love their lists."
He smiled patronizingly.
"From the Ten Commandments to the Hollywood blacklist, from Nixon's enemies list to Schindler's list to the New York Times bestseller list, from Santa Claus's list to God's list separating sheep from the goats."
He went on to describe genealogies as lists, taxonomies, inventories. He finished his glass of sherry, poured another, drank that and poured another.
"Our much-flaunted Bill of Rights is a list, as was Martin Luther's 95 Theses nailed to the cathedral door during the Festival of Fasching."
When Jamal and Keyshawn looked at him with blank expressions, he bellowed, "If you two had read your Lewis Hyde and Victor Turner instead of smoking bath salts and playing Pokemon Go, you'd know of what I speak." Slipping easily into a lecture he'd delivered countless times, he declared, "Power reversal rituals." Jamal and Keyshawn steeled themselves for a long-winded didactic sermon. Brawley's dissertation gushed forth. Most civil societies perpetuated their status quo by practicing these rituals. For a short period each year, sometimes seasonally, the lowest-ranking citizens were granted power over their superiors. In modern societies, this still occurred at Halloween, the juncture between summer and autumn, and supposedly between the living and the dead. On the night of October 31st, powerless children donned the costumes of outsiders, of animals and the dead, and outcast loners such as cowboys and hobos, boys dressed as girls and girls as boys, and all these alien others had the power to roam freely and demand tribute from property-owning upright members of society. If no tribute was paid, the threat of trick-or-treat promised property damage. "Why," the doctor sputtered, "by the 1920s, so many homes were burned and so many tires slashed that newspapers colluded with the insurance and confectionery companies to institute the ritual of giving away candy." He marveled. "Picture it. The poor burned the homes of the rich. All offenses of the preceding year were revenged. Even Christmas caroling, heartwarming, traditional Christmas caroling, had been a blood sport. The poor congregated outside the homes of the wealthy and sang as a threat. Nothing but bribes of gold and rich food would dispatch them to the next house. Our practice of offering flowers at a funeral originated with an ancient ritual wherein the local poor would gather wildflowers and fragrant herbs. They would arrive at the dead man's casket and hand these gifts to the mourners in exchange for money and bread." With obvious childlike enthusiasm, the doctor splashed his bare feet in the tub of water. He declared, "The military is rife with traditional occasions when officers must obey their inferiors for a brief period. Aboard nuclear submarines, every tour features a Jefe's Cafe night. Dinner is celebrated by the ship's officers decorating the mess as a fancy restaurant, and then themselves cooking and serving the enlisted personnel a gourmet meal. Similarly, in antebellum America, the power reversal ritual was known as Saturnalia. At Christmas time, a plantation owner would give his slaves gifts and allow them to travel short distances to visit relatives on neighboring plantations. All of the slaves were given several days of freedom. They received all the apple brandy they could drink and all the pork they could eat. As reported by Frederick Douglass, the slaves would eat, drink, and carouse until they were sick. Every year, this sickness of excess left them miserable. It convinced the slaves they were weak-willed. They needed a master to control them and their base impulses. After a few days of binging on everything, they were happy to return to being slaves." This far along, the doctor's lecture was long and liquored and indulgent. "For the Amish," Brawley droned on, "it's their curious practice of rumspringa, a word which translates to running or jumping around. At the cusp of adulthood, Amish adolescents are allowed to enjoy the fruits of the outside world. Like the slave enjoying Saturnalia, the Amish youngsters inevitably overindulge in drugs and sex and tedious minimum-wage lifestyles. After they make themselves miserable," Brawley crowed, "they're only too happy to return to the plain and simple Amish life." Jamal looked at his wristwatch. Keyshawn resisted the urge to check his text messages. Clearly the professor was on a roll. The doctor paused to catch his breath, with liquor shining on his lips and the rambling wisps of his long gray hair that had escaped his ponytail. He looked like nothing less than a wizard. Some jabbering heretic. Fixing his small audience with a gleaming eye, he asked, "Do you know why this country, supposedly the wisest, most successful human experiment, does not practice a power reversal ritual?" When neither of the two young men spoke, the doctor shouted, "Carnival!" He bellowed, "Fasching!" The latter was a word derived from the German term for last call. It was the equivalent of modern Mardi Gras, a final carnal indulgence before the hardships and self-denial of Lent. In 17th century Bavaria, the power reversal ritual allowed peasants to eat and party and sometimes copulate in the churches and cathedrals, while the celebratory parades featured monks and priests riding on wagons, the equivalent of our parade floats, while throwing feces at the onlookers. The profane became sacred, and the sacred profane, but only for a short time. Nevertheless, it was within this lawless window that Martin Luther made his move. He posted his objections to the Catholic Church, and in doing so, he founded Protestantism. "You'll agree that the United States is nothing if not a Protestant nation?" Brawley asked, adding, "at least at its founding." Because the Protestant religions had been created during a power reversal ritual, those religions have always been wary of such a practice. Brawley nodded knowingly. "The Pope, His Holiness, will continue to wash and kiss the feet of the poor on Holy Thursday, but the Protestants will never risk the same vulnerability." That was the fatal flaw of this great country, he surmised. It never allowed the weakest, the poorest, and most disenfranchised to enjoy even an hour of ritualized power. Yes, we had castrated versions like Halloween and Christmas caroling for children, but there was nothing to exhaust the adult underclasses and leave them contented to remain poor for another year. Jamal allowed a respectful amount of time to pass before he tried to redirect. "So, the list?" "Desperate," Kishan begged. "Is it real?" Drowsy and a little soused, Dr. Brawley tut-tutted. He lifted a pale hand and toyed with a few strands of his wild hair. "As a cultural anthropologist, I have long heard of this fabled list," he assured them. "And it is an urban myth, a complete fantasy." The two students couldn't help but look crestfallen. They'd come here asking about Walter, trying to discover if the professor could help them. He could not, or would not. This was a dead end. As if sensing their disappointment, Dr. Brawley stirred. Perhaps to appease them, maybe just to flirt, he asked, "This mythical list, strictly from an anthropological standpoint," he asked, "what happens if a nominee gets too many votes?" His eyes downcast, Kishan edged forward until he knelt at Brawley's feet. The water in the plastic tub had long ceased to steam. Kishan reached for the folded towel. "It's like this," he began, and gently lifted one pale foot from the temple.